Chapter 14. Gorm awoke with a cold sweat on his brow and a scream in his throat. His fists were clenched and his knuckles white as he thrashed into a sitting position. Blood pounded in his ears so hard it sounded like a roaring beast.
"Keep it down," said a voice beside him,
prompting another yell from Gorm. Bert was standing atop his rucksack.
"Oh," said Gorm, "it's ye."
"Oh, welcome back, Bert," the kobold pantomimed. "Haven't seen you in a week, Bert. Sorry I abandoned you in the wilderness, Bert."
Gorm rubbed his temple as if to dislodge the last of his memories. Inky black tentacles still swam in his mind's eye, and he could almost hear the echoes of Azanon's laughter.
"Aye, sorry. Sorry, I just had the most terrible dream."
"Yeah, things aren't too much better out there either,"
said the kobold, jabbing a thumb over his shoulder at the tent flap.
"They could use your help."
Gorm paused to listen. His heart's pounding had slowed a bit, but the roaring sound remained, and now it was punctuated by the shouts of his party.
"Bones,"
he swore, scrambling for the tent flap. The wan light of an oncoming dawn filtered into the campsite. Heraldin and Geist stood stiffly by the dying remnants of the cookfire, weapons drawn, while the mages tried to calm them with outstretched hands and presumably reassuring words. It was difficult to make out what they were saying, however, as there was a troll storming around the camp.
"Gone!" bellowed Thane, running in panicked circles. "She's gone!"
"Gorm!" shouted Heraldin, wearing a forced grin as he turned to the dwarf. "Jin and Laruna say you might offer some explanation for this."
"In a minute,"
said Gorm, marching past the other heroes. "Thane!" The troll stopped in his tracks, wild eyes focusing on the dwarf. Something primal in Gorm shoved his heart into his throat. Friend or not, staring down a furious troll was enough to freeze the blood. He took a deep breath.
"Thane?
It's me, Gorm." "She's gone," said Thane. "Gorm, she's gone."
"Caitha's left?"
Gorm turned to the other heroes.
"That seems to be the matter at hand, yes," said Jin.
"One of them," said Heraldin, eyes never leaving the troll.
"And she left her weapons and armor behind," said Laruna, holding up a bow and quiver.
"Why would she do that?"
Gorm shook his head.
"But we'll find her. We will."
The troll nodded. He was still breathing heavily as he sat back on his haunches. Heraldin seized Gorm's arm.
"You knew about this?"
he hissed.
"Aye. Thane's been protecting us for a long time now, but we got bigger problems to deal with."
Gorm brushed the bard's hand aside, along with his comments.
"Bigger? This one's twice as tall as a man and just destroyed our campsite," said the bard. "I thought we trusted each other."
Gorm raised his eyebrows in reply.
"Okay, fair enough," conceded the bard. "But I thought we weren't keeping these sorts of secrets, at least, right?"
The bard looked back at the weapons master. Geist shrugged.
"We'll talk about it later. Our ranger's gone missing in the wilderness, unarmed,"
Gorm told the bard.
"We have to find her," fretted the troll.
"This isn't something you just shrug off," snarled the bard. "It sure as fire ain't something you'll make me talk about while the lass is missing," snapped Gorm.
"She needs her potions," said Thane.
"Aye,"
Gorm gestured to the troll.
"She needs her... Wait, what now?"
"These,"
said Thane, reaching into his pouch. He pulled out a couple of vials of elixir and handed them to Gorm.
"I hate it when she takes them. She has to cut her arms, and then it's like she's not herself. But if I don't let her have any for too long, she shakes and acts strange."
"So you bought her healing potions?"
asked Gorm.
"No, of course not," insisted the troll. "She finds them on her own. Gods know how. I've just been keeping the potions from her, unless she really needs one."
"How?" demanded Jin.
"Ah, well, I am sorry about this part," said Thane, scratching the fur on the back of his head.
He pulled another fistful of vials from his pouch, and then a third. Soon a mound of bottles of elixir lay at Gorm's feet.
"I've been managing the party supply. I make sure the only potions available are what's needed, and I keep the rest safe."
"Okay, I didn't know anything about that,"
Gorm told Heraldin.
"Do you think that makes it any better?" said the bard.
"I think I knew," said Laruna quietly. "Well, not that Thane was hoarding salve, But I've suspected Katha had a problem with healing potions since we left Vechel.
Why didn't you say something? Asked Gorm.
Well, if that isn't the orc calling the goblin green, said the bard, her addiction might have come to light earlier if your troll here wasn't keeping her in supply. Thane turned away as though struck in the face.
I'm sorry.
Jin took Laruna's hand in his own. Listen, I'm sure we all realize that it's best not to keep secrets from the party, said Jin. I learned that lesson myself a year ago. But we need to focus on what's important now. Katha is likely suffering from withdrawal from Elixir. She could be hallucinating, or delusional, or...
He trailed off, and the silence spoke volumes.
Aye, said Gorm grimly. We all know what it could be.
So we go after her, said Heraldin.
Just like that! Bert's hackles rose. You couldn't wait an hour for the kobold and troll to get back to camp, but you're going to just drop everything to charge after the elf?
Bert has a point, said Gorm.
Thank you,
said the kobold.
Gorm shook his head. Much as I hate to say it, the undead could reach the fortress gates any day now, and if Laruna ain't there with that fancy staff, the whole world's at risk.
That wasn't the point, Bert barked.
We can't just leave Katha, said the Solomancer firmly.
I know, but we can't just abandon our quest, said Jin.
So what? Said Heraldin. We split the party? We can't split the party. Not any more than it has been, said Gorm. But without our ranger, there's only one of us with any chance of tracking Katha through the wilderness.
The adventurers looked as one to the troll, who looked uncomfortable with the sudden attention.
I don't know if I can do it.
You found us, didn't you? Said Gorm. You're the only one who can bring her back safe.
The troll hesitated.
But when she sees me, she might... What if she...
And what if you don't go? Asked Laruna, pressing Katha's bow and quiver into the troll's hands.
Thane stared at the ground and took a deep breath. When he looked back up, any traces of indecision on his gnarled face had melted away, leaving only stony resolution.
I'll do it, he said.
Gorm looked east, where the glow of dawn had set the edge of the mountains ablaze.
Good, he said. You best get moving. We all should, for that matter. We've got to make for High Watch.
I know they're making for High Watch, said Gerald Flynn. The question is, how are they moving so fast?
The mechanical gazer chittered softly, a sibilant chatter produced by the muffled prattling of the sprites encased within Barty's hideous creation. The construct had 7 tentacles made from interlocking plates, each terminating in a glass orb that contained an enchanted sprite of some variety. Search sprites, sentry sprites, pathfinder sprites. The 7 arms connected to a brass orb, featureless save for a pair of whirling propellers and a large porthole, luminous with the glow of additional sprites fluttering among the gears within. A hatch approximating a mouth swiveled downward, the tiny shouts of trapped sprites strung together in a high-pitched cacophony, but Flynn could catch a few words above the din.
Don't know! Teleportation? It's probably magic! Elven horses? Giant eagles!
Enough,
said Flynn, waving a hand. The little flying construct shut its hatch obediently and hovered over to the unit of combat golems. The 12 sorceress constructs kept pace with the assassin's horses, striding along in their odd 4-legged gait. Flynn wished he could send the rest of Barty's golems ahead to scout, but Mr. Fisser had a certain modus remotus operandi that mandated the engineer remain safely in Andoran, and left his combat golems unable to do much beyond their basic murder protocols.
The Lich might do our work for us, said Deathbloom.
Do our contracts have an undeath clause? Asked Udina.
Flynn pursed his lips.
No, I have it on good authority that the undead will fall swiftly, and even if they got to Mr. Ingerson beforehand, the dwarf has a habit of surviving circumstances that he shouldn't. We'll need proof that he and his companions are dead.
Captain Jones pulled up beside the Tinderkin.
Yar, that may be, but if we sail too close to the reefs of the damned...
Just say it like a normal person, sighed Flynn.
If we get too close to the thrice-cursed undead, they may do Ingerson's work for him, said Captain Jones.
I've no desire to face Datar Ermion, said Mortis. Neither did Mr. Flynn. Then again, he'd seen what Johann the Mighty was capable of, and he'd set himself against anything living or dead before he'd get on the wrong side of the paladin. He gave the other assassins a tight smile. All the more reason to make haste.
That's right. You'd best get moving fast, said the bannerman. You won't get in here. Nobody gets into High Watch. You've said as much, said Gorm, but you need to listen.
We can stop the lich, Jin said.
The guard's face wasn't discernible through the slot in the iron-bound door, but he managed to effectively convey a smirk nonetheless.
Oh, so the five of you have the key to stopping the undead. I suppose the fate of the whole world depends on you right now.
Yes, said Laruna.
Yeah, same as every one of the thousand heroes up on the walls, said the bannerman. You know how many times I've heard this spiel in the past 3 days?
Heraldin raised a hand.
But listen, everybody wants a shot at the loot and the points that are gonna flow when the undead finally fall. And everybody thinks they're the chosen ones who finally found the secret to bringing down the lich, said the bannerman wearily. But everybody else has a corporate sponsor and a contract to fulfill the quest and arrived with His Majesty's army as requested by the Heroes Guild. So, if you want me to open this door, you had better have a remarkably good reason.
Gorm hesitated. Talking about the Wormwood staff would be tantamount to confessing to robbing the Museum of Andoran. He couldn't imagine many worse places for the crime to come to light than in a massive fortress full of bannermen and guild heroes.
It's our destiny? He tried.
Right. Look, the undead will arrive by nightfall. You could be nearly a day's ride away from Highwatch by then, and that's exactly what I would do in your shoes. But if you want to stick yourself between the lich and the walls, that's your problem, so long as you sod off, said the bannerman. The slot in the door snapped shut.
And so here we are, locked out in the middle of nowhere with the undead bearing down on us, said Heraldin, throwing his arms in the air.
Don't be so dramatic, said Jin.
First of all, being dramatic is my job. I am a bard.
It's easy to forget, given the way you play the lute, said Laruna.
Hurtful. And second, continued Heraldin, this is exactly where I expected to wind up.
Don't matter now. We need a new plan, said Gorm.
We could break down the gate, suggested Laruna, force our way in and then try to sneak up to the ramparts in the confusion.
Gorm looked up at the wall in front of them, as tall and unassailable as the mountain cliffs around it. The banners on the fortress towers looked like ship sails on a vertical horizon. He shook his head.
Nobody's ever forced their way into High Watch, lass, and plenty of armies have tried. This is just the door to the gatehouse. There's a bigger gate behind it, and 100 more in the tunnels beneath the fortress. We'd get nowhere.
Well, we can't take the undead on from down here, said Laruna. We'll be trapped with our backs to the wall.
I think I know a way, said Bert, poking his head out of Gorm's rucksack. Or at least, I know about a way.
A way into High Watch? Asked Laruna.
Well, no, but almost as good, said Bert. See, our legends say that kobolds used to live in the mountains south of High Watch. Back when heroics was still more of a hobby than a profession, humans and dwarves used to run quests to drive out the Highwall tribes and loot their lairs. So this one kobold, Ratrup, decides he's sick of his people getting murdered and robbed. He and his warriors make a path up the mountain next to High Watch and set up their own fort there. From there, he could keep an eye on High Watch and warn the other kobolds when any adventurers were riding out to quest.
I'm not familiar with that story, said Heraldin.
Bert snorted. And how many kobold legends do you know?
Fair enough, said Heraldin. Still, I'm not sure we should go chasing after it, said Laruna. Even if the legends are true, and Ratrup did build a fort, there's no way to know if it's still around.
Of course there ain't, said Bert. It's not like anyone's been there since back in the Sixth Age. The Highwall tribes got driven out long ago, and nobody's left to care what the Lightlings are doing in High Watch. But Ratrup's path might still be there, and if it can get you to a good defensible point within line of sight to the battle, maybe you can, I don't know, do whatever it is that staff does.
It's a chance at least, said Gorm.
A slim one, said Jin.
That's as good as we ever get these days, Gorm set off. Let's go.
The adventurers led their horses down the winding path away from Highwatch's western gate toward the scrublands at the base of the mountains. They mounted and rode south once they reached the foot of the mountain, making their way around the rocks and crevasses along the edge of the high walls. Bert gave up his spot in Gorm's rucksack to ride in the saddle in front of the dwarf. The kobold's misshapen ears were perked up and alert. His long tongue flapped in the wind as the horse raced through the low brush. It was nearly noon when the kobold leapt up, his tail wagging furiously.
There! Right there!
Hold up!
Hollered Gorm, raising a hand. Bert led them a short way up the side of the mountain to a large boulder with several smooth stones piled atop it. At its foot, they found a stake in the ground with a rusted chain dangling from it.
This marker probably used to have a bunch of bones and skulls around it, said Bert.
He scratched at the ground and sniffed.
And kobolds have been here since Ratrup's day. A group came through a few years back. The path to Ratrup's watch must be nearby.
There, said Laruna, pointing to a cleft in the rocks a few dozen yards up the mountains. Looking at the crack from a specific angle, the heroes could see a small gravelly path winding up the mountainside before it disappeared around a bend.
That's it! We've found it! Said Bert.
He sidled up to the small marker by the boulder and started to untie the drawstring of his trousers.
Now hang on a second. I gotta do a thing.
What are you—
Ah, bones, Bert!
Gorm turned away and shut his eyes tightly. The other adventurers groaned and shook their heads as they headed for the trail.
Oh, grow up, Bert called over his shoulder. I'm letting future kobolds know I was here.
So carve a note into a tree trunk, said Laruna, already stepping through the cleft in the rock.
Hey, wait up! I'm almost finished,
Bert yelled. The stream of heroes pouring into Hertzwood had dried up in the first days of Dawngreen. The city was, by all accounts, little more than a support system for the massive Heroes Guild office that dominated the center of town. Yet despite being the Freedland's easternmost bastion of professional heroics, Hertzwood usually had remarkably few heroes in residence. Adventurers were financially motivated to spend more time dungeon spelunking or ranging in the field than doing paperwork. When a particularly important quest was launched from the Hertzwood Guild Hall, the city's population swelled to the bursting point. When fame and fortune were better sought elsewhere, Hertzwood shrank back down to a ghost town, populated by clerks, shopkeepers, and the odd hero popping in for an eye exam. Once soldiers and adventurers sent to fight the undead moved on to Highwatch, the Guild Hall was largely silent. Clerks and laborers quietly prepared the ledgers and loading bays for a sudden influx of ectoplasm-soaked loot. Calm and quiet had returned to the sleepy town. And then the Red Horde came. It was a host out of the Agekeeper's histories, the sort of giant war band that Manon once set out against the great elven cities. The Shadowkin aptly referred to such an army as Zabarundar, or a Great Storm. The army of raiders spread out over the plains of Aberyth like a thunderhead, and their arrows and slingstones fell like rain. Orcs, goblins, gnolls, kobolds, slaw, gremlins, ogres, and even a few naga scaled the walls and flooded into the city streets. The defenders, such as they were, barely had time to ring the warning bells before they were overwhelmed, and the fight, such as it was, ended before most of the invaders had seen a foe. Shortly thereafter, a smaller yet equally intense fight broke out in a back office of Hertzwood's former guild hall.
"You always do this,"
growled Darek, trying to contain his growing fury.
"You have done such since we were whelps."
"I am truly sorry, my chieftain."
Ashurzu put a sardonic spin on the honorific, turning her brother's title into a metaphorical tweak in the ear. There is a particular rage that only a sibling can inspire, and it bloomed across Darek's deep green features.
"Why must you dishonor me so? And do not feign ignorance like some simpering gnome."
There is also a particular delight that can only be attained by irking a sibling, and it took all of Ashurzu's will to hide it.
I do not know what you speak of, honored chieftain.
You know exactly what I speak of, snarled Darak. I brought you on this raid to show the Gizvarda that we remain unified, and yet you have done nothing but sow discontent among the ranks.
Now Ashurzu felt her own blood rising in her cheeks.
I did nothing of the sort, she hissed. The Gizvarda came to me with their own concerns, as did many other warriors. They wondered where the honor is in attacking an empty town, or why we would risk ourselves for so little plunder. I did not tell our people what to think. I warned you of their thoughts.
In view of my generals, in the presence of Grignot and his warriors.
Darak shook his head.
You are supposed to be a wise one now. Do you know nothing of command and power? Your words make me look weak.
You make yourself look weak when you fawn over that snake,
Ashurzu snapped back.
Your people are frightened and unhappy, and all you care about are the thoughts of Grignot and his fools.
Enough, hissed the chieftain. All I care about is family, father's people, Char's legacy, the memories of Chalu, Durdadzu, and Frak, and always your well-being. Everything I do is for us. Everything! And you still dishonor me and treat me as a child.
Ashurzu glimpsed the brother she helped raise in the Lord of the Red Horde's rage.
I am sorry.
No! Darak hissed. No more! There is much to do, and we must be away soon. I cannot have you making more trouble for me. Seek me out when you can speak without shaming our family.
With that, the chieftain kicked the door open and stalked out into the hallway. Ashurzu exhaled through her fangs and kicked idly at an overturned filing cabinet. There was nothing to be done when Darak had set his mind to something. Her brother's stubbornness had earned the pet name Little Warg when he was but a whelp, and just as with Warg pups, his tenacity had become less endearing with time. She shook her head and reminded herself that this wasn't all her brother's fault, especially when it was apparent that Grignot was taking over the tribe. Jorik once told a young Ashurzu that a weak mind is a malleable one. Once it is convinced it has been lied to, it begins to lie to itself. Once persuaded that it is hated, it becomes hateful. Once made to fear violence, it becomes violent. Now the Orcus saw the unfortunate truth of Jorik's wisdom all too well. Grignot's constant raving about the Lightling's evils was twisting the Red Horde into the murderous caricatures that they claimed to stand against. And while most Shadowkin she knew saw his warped fantasies for what they were, they had something more tangible to fear. The Horde was becoming less tolerant of dissent by the day. Ashurzu's station as the chieftain's sister had inoculated her against recrimination thus far, but there was no telling how long Darak could protect her, or if he even wanted to. Ashurzu shook the foul thought from her head. Darak was comprised entirely of muscle and loyalty, and for all her brother's flaws, she knew she could depend on him. A horn in the distance snapped her from her reflections. Like the great storms the Zabarundar was named for, the warband never stayed in one place for long. It arrived like thunder, it struck like lightning, and it was away like the wind, ideally with heaps of plunder in its collective arms. Darak would be happier if she returned with at least a little loot. Ashurzu had refused to take part in any killing, but she could pillage a bit for show. She was scanning the room for something of apparent value when a familiar face caught her eye. The poster on the far wall clearly bore a portrait of Gorm Ingerson, and it was labeled with his name, but the text below it promised a large sum of money for his capture. It was surrounded by several other portraits, most of which were recognizable as Gorm's treacherous band, save the horrifying woodcut on the poster labeled Haraldin Strummans. More shocking than the bard's hideous features, however, were the descriptions of the party's crimes. All of the posters accused the guild heroes of colluding with the orcs of Bloodroot to murder Niln of the Almatrans. Ashurzu pulled the posters from the wall and read them again.
These were clearly the heroes she remembered from her father's last days, but they had never spoken an ill word of Niln. The orcs had thought of Gorm, Niln, and their party as friends when they'd parted, and that opinion hadn't changed until the guild heroes came and made Gorm's betrayal apparent. Had Gorm betrayed Niln and the Heroes' Guild? But if so, why would the posters implicate the orcs as well? Why would the guild invent a crime for a band of criminals? A second blast of the horn reminded Ashurzu that she needed to hurry. Any reflections on Gorm's betrayal would have to wait. She tucked the posters into her satchel, grabbed a valuable-looking urn from the top of a desk, and ran out to join the rest of the Zabarundar.
"The what?" shouted Handor. "I said a great storm, Your Majesty!"
Johann reached over the king's shoulder to point at looming thunderclouds on the eastern horizon.
"Perfect," grumbled Handor, looking at the dark clouds. He gripped his pommel tightly as the great eagle veered in the wind.
Handor hated flying. He hated seeing the ground whisk by below his mount, and he really hated the deadly space between him and the ground. He'd thought flying at night might be better, but as it turned out, blurring the world into a black and blue smear speeding beneath him did little for his nerves. Icy wind burned across his face, and the straps of his flight goggles whipped at his skin.
"We'll beat it! Look!" Johann hollered from the back of the double saddle.
The paladin pointed again, this time to a flicker of lights in the mountain. High Watch. The high walls were aptly named, as their craggy peaks were marked by sheer cliffs that rose to dizzying heights above the plains and forests. At their northernmost tip sat High Watch, a mountain fortress that was more like a fortified mountain. Handor nodded, trying to wiggle the numbness out of his extremities and willing the eagle to descend faster. Eventually he could make out the shape of High Watch's inner courtyard, outlined in torches and flaming braziers. Much of the fortress was separated from the surrounding mountains by a black chasm. According to Johann, the only way to the keep was through the tunnels and hallways beneath the fortress, all controlled by a complex series of interlocking gates.
"We'll be landing soon, sire," Johann yelled.
Those riding the other great eagles in the flock couldn't be heard at all. Handor could only just see them in the gloom of the moonlight. Daniel Clubs appeared to be talking incessantly to Weaver Ortson atop the eagle to his left. On his other side, Goldson and Bags sat in stoic silence. Handor started when he realized that they were both reading small ledgers propped up on their saddles.
"The orbs," Johann called, pointing.
Handor wiped his goggles and looked again. Now he could see the great green orbs set up along the stone ramparts of the outer wall. Bannermen and Umbraxian workers scurried around them, finalizing preparations. He spotted a couple orbs set up in the courtyard, likely a precaution against the unthinkable.
"Seems to be coming along nicely," the paladin yelled.
Handor nodded. The great eagles carrying the king's guard were already touching down on the top of the inner keep. Handor watched the bannermen and heroes fan out and form a perimeter as his own eagle finally swooped in to land.
"I trust Your Majesty's flight was a good one," said Fenrir Goldson as Johann helped the king dismount.
"Yes, fine, wonderful," grumbled Handor.
It perturbed the king that everyone else seemed to enjoy flying so much. They focused on the sensation of being in the air, the speed at which you traveled, the majesty of the eagles. Handor didn't think any of that justified the terror of the ground beneath him, the nausea of rising and falling so suddenly, and the frozen snot that encrusted his whiskers after a ride in the icy air.
"We shall have to invite you to fly out of the city with us more often," said Bowlby Bags, stepping down beside Goldson.
"And under happier circumstances," said Goldson.
"Certainly, certainly."
Handor tried to discreetly clean his facial hair. He found a handy distraction in Weaver Ortson plodding up to them.
"Ortson, I am surprised your heroes don't use these all the time."
"Sire?"
The loose straps of Ortson's goggles slapped his face as he looked around in confusion.
"The eagles, Ortson. One can imagine uses for great eagles on just about any quest the Heroes Guild could undertake."
Handor nodded to his eagle. It eyed him dispassionately before preening its neck,
Why, how many strange and dangerous journeys could heroes skip if great eagles were on hand to carry them to any destination? And what danger could they not escape if the eagles were waiting to sweep them away? I should think you'd want to employ the birds all the time.
And we would, sire, believe me, said Ortson, but the accursed creatures have unionized.
Unionized? Handor stopped brushing his mustache. Handor's eagle made a satisfied clicking noise.
Oh, yes, sire. The United Avian Workers dictates all the terms when it comes to hiring great eagles for any job. Giant falcons and direhawks as well. And once you factor in overtime and hazard pay, there's no way we could afford to have them on anything but a fraction of our quests.
A pity, said Goldson.
The eagle gave a high-pitched cry.
"Yes, you can go on your thrice-cursed break," snapped Ortson. 20 minutes, and not a moment longer!"
The eagles snapped their beaks at the Grandmaster, but collectively shuffled off toward the far corner of the keep.
"This way, Your Majesty," said Johann. "The heralds are announcing you now."
"Very well." Handor headed across the flat roof to a small raised platform. Aides and attendants helped him remove his goggles and flight helmet as he walked, and a circlet was placed on his head as he stepped onto the dais. Below and all around him, bannermen looked up from their duties expectantly. He hadn't prepared a speech, and he didn't understand the tactics, but he was more than familiar with appeals to blind patriotism.
"For Andoran," he hollered, thrusting a bony fist into the air. "For the Freedlands!"
"For Andoran," the bannermen echoed, raising their weapons in reply.
"For the king!"
Yet the cry faded as quickly as it was raised.
"Well said, sire," said Johann.
"Perhaps," said Handor. "That sort of thing usually gets them cheering and singing for at least a few minutes." General Gergen, high commander of the bannermen, stepped forward. She was an ex-hero, with one gray eye and a nose that still looked broken in a few places. Her hair was cropped short, and her suit of silver armor was scratched and dented.
"You must pardon them, Majesty," she said in a low, crackling voice. "They have other things on their mind."
She nodded to the horizon. Handor turned, and his insides turned to jelly. At first it looked like the storm clouds were casting black shadows over the Ruskan landscape, but then he saw the glowing specters twisting above the black tide. A vast army crept over the land like a foul mold overtaking a carcass.
"Bones," he swore.
"Indeed, sire," said the general. "The Lich's force is at least 3 times the size of our own, though there's no way to know if we've yet seen the end of their numbers. It is a threat unlike anything we've seen in our lifetime."
"When will they attack?" Handor's lips were dry and his belly had turned to soup.
"They should reach the walls by midnight, if our scouts are correct. I doubt they'll wait for dawn to attack. You can be certain that some of those soldiers are going to die tonight."
She thought for a moment and added, "More than once in some cases."
"I see," said Handor, mustering his courage. And do you think we'll carry the day?"
The general considered the question carefully before nodding.
"I do," she said.
"We have the orbs, after all," said Bags.
"They're very, very good orbs," said Clubs. "The best! And they're going to—"
Ortson mercifully cut the blathering businessman off.
"And we have the best of the guild's heroes assembled here."
"Plus we have a greater power on our side," added Johann.
Goldson and Bags rolled their eyes, and Handor could understand why. The king often surmised that Tandos must truly be a god of the people, because his champion always seemed to find religion in public places.
"Those are all well and good," said General Gergen, "but we'll carry the day because we're in High Watch. In war after war, for ages upon ages, this fortress has never fallen."
King Handor watched the coming darkness on the horizon.
"Let us hope that you are right, General. Gods help us if it falls now."